For more episodes just like this one on a weekly basis, subscribe to RLRCPSolvers.com. You will not regret it.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers.
Woo! How was that?
I give it a 6 out of 10.
You know what? Mediocre is the way to go. Don't overshoot, don't undershoot. Honestly, 6 out of 10. 6 out of 10 is perfect. You know what's not mediocre, Prof. Rez?
What's that?
The discipline of diagnosis. It's not mediocre. You know, so many people have talked to me specifically about the pharyngitis chapter, which has me both very proud of your decision to lead with that, but also very skeptical of the people who keep talking to me about it, because I think that that's probably maybe all that they've read. but they all seem to be riveted by story. And I really, really hope that all of you listening to this, if you haven't gotten the book yet, at least think about it, because if you're listening to this, what that will offer you is this on steroids, concentrated, personalized, and some. So a mere $9.99 on Kindle, and if you have a strong appetite for a paperback to hold the memories in physical form, you just pay 3 Kindles and you get a book. Or, three, a little bit more than three. Yeah, do it. And then, you know what? If you don't like it, just that's it. You suffer not much more, and then you hopefully stay with us on lifelong learning. But, pharyngitis is crazy. And I was thinking about that, Prof. Rez, because I know it's a full circle moment. You're going and flying to meet with said cherished family member in a week. So, buy the book. Please. Thank you.
You know, and this is just like honest reflection.
Yeah.
Robbie, you've taken care of so many cases of pharyngitis that you have developed a beautiful algorithm. Mm. And you didn't create this algorithm after I told you about my sister's case. You had it built.
Yeah.
And if we had access to that algorithm, her complication from pharyngitis, I'm going to say would 100% have been avoided. And I'm just saying that, like, we're going to do on the RLR podcast cases of pharyngitis. Robbie's going to
next week
present the whole spectrum. But it's just so, like, that is just so magnificent. Like, that approach you created, I honestly, that approach is just a game changer. And I just,
So you that's think it's one worth thing $27?
Oh, dude, I swear I would pay hundreds of dollars. But I mean, I can. Luckily, I'm in that position, but I would pay hundreds of dollars for that approach.
Oh my gosh.
I need it.
Oh, now I know how to get rich. Just charge Prof. Rez for the scheme.
Well, listen, I just want to show some gratitude towards the RLR family, towards any CP Solver member, but especially towards you, man. It's been like a tough moment in my life, and you've been there. And, in those moments, you just become closer to the people you really love. And so I'm really grateful to you, man. Like, I felt my pain you carried, and you were just there to check in, to listen, to provide me, kind words. So thank you.
Yeah. Prof. Rez, I was unsure if you were going to go that route or not, but I feel so stupid because you are nothing but authentic and real. And, I think folks are probably really intrigued as to what you're referring to. So I'll let you decide how much you want to elaborate on. But I know it's difficult.
So I actually, part of me wanted to just put this in our library of podcasts. So later when we're demented, we go back. Because I feel this RLR series is way more than just cases.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's even more than just the community we've built. It's literally our library and our timestamps for various moments in our lives, some sad, some great, some, every emotion you can think of. But You know, and I think if you've never had a pet, you won't know this feel, and it's not your fault because I remember when my friend's pet passed, he like went into a depression for a year, and I was like, well, how could that be? It's just a pet. Fast forward, now I'm a cat dad, and one of our cats, unfortunately, like in itself could be a really a clinical case that I present to Robbie. He had some eyelid swelling. We thought it was allergies. Then we had a vet visit him, and we thought it was maybe a conjunctivitis, a periorbital abscess, but ultimately he was diagnosed with osteosarcoma of the sinus. And about a month after, he passed away. And it was probably the hardest thing I've gone through in my life. And because this pet, Gino, he literally would sit on my lap every night for dinner. And that's the only time he would sit on my lap because he always prioritized Liz appropriately because Liz had him for 13 years. So I would take advantage. I would eat my dinner with the plate in the air and Gino on my lap. I would make sure,
Really?
I swear to God, to make sure he's not disturbed. And then the bastard, as soon as my dinner would end and Liz with the blanket on her lap, he would like dash over to her
Oh,
as I was
man.
serving him. And though really, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to talk about this too long, but there's just two things I took away from this and I wanted to share it with the audience. Number one, something that gave me so much peace, you know, during these difficult moments was the fact I treated him with unconditional love. And I was thinking to myself, you know, one day we're all going to leave. Maybe some people leave before us. Maybe we die first. But I think the thing I want to carry with me for each of my interactions with anyone is that I did no harm. And I was like the best brother I could be, the best friend I could be, the best son I could be. And realizing life is short and knowing that you were just a good person towards others gives so much, you know, comfort. And then the second thing, what Liz and I started doing is showing, saying grace before dinner and like not taking things for granted. Like, for example, when Gino was able to balance on our thigh, we never thought anything of it. But when he lost that ability, we're like, man, this is so sad. And just being grateful and showing gratitude to things that you probably, all of us, take for granted on a regular basis. But of course, I miss that guy so much. I'm glad he's not suffering anymore. And all I wish for is for Liz to have some comfort. I know for her, it's even more difficult being his mom for 13 years. And the other thing that Gino taught me is that I always thought like I wanted to pass on my genetics to a biological kid. I no longer feel that way because Gino wasn't my genetics and I loved him more than anything in this world. And so like I know Liz always wanted to adopt. So I think when the time comes, we're gonna head the route of adoption. And like
That's so
Gino
good.
taught me that, you know, and
That's so good.
nothing wrong with wanting to pass on your genetics, but gosh, I know the world doesn't need any more of my genes, but
Oh,
more
what?
importantly, I would rather, much rather adopt at this point when, if we end up doing that. Otherwise, we'll get a ship somewhere, a cruise ship, and just be sailing the Mediterranean, inviting you and Karen, your kids over
Oh
to
my
hang
God.
out with us on our sailboat.
Oh man, friends, I think, these horrible moments are horrible. But life is beautiful. It really is. And the fact that a human being and a cat got to make the most beautiful epic memories is unreal. And I'm not going to talk much because I know it's triggering, and of course, naturally, but when you think what's on the other side of what you're mourning, it's unreal. It's so beautiful. And what I love about this space is the relationship that's fostered over here, and why you decided to go on record to have memory for us as demented. And all these people who are listening to this, we're all building a bond with them directly or indirectly. And I think that's the most beautiful part of life. And that's the only part that matters, is to build those bonds with people. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what purse or shirt or a class of airline you fly from.
We're gonna save that story for another time.
I know, I know.
What a
Thank you.
story.
Yeah.
But
Well, shut me up and keep going, Professor.
Robbie, I have a case for you that I really like, I mean it. I think you have to be the person who discusses this because I think you can relate most to the providers caring for this patient. And it's a case that I think everyone listening needs to be well aware. And I can't wait to see how you dissect this, using your emergency department skills. And I want you to be totally authentic as you always are. So here's the story. A 65-year-old man, he loves to ride his bike around the VA campus. And as he's riding his bike, he feels a bit lightheaded to the point where he has to actually get off his bike and walk a little bit. And he thinks he just needs to go home, take a nap, and just sleep it off. So he goes home, takes a nap, he sleeps it off, feels better, and then starts going for a walk later in the day. But again, like feeling a little unsteady, lightheadedness, no loss of consciousness. In that context, he comes to the emergency department. He comes to the ED. He shares a story that I just shared with you. No chest pain, no shortness of breath, no palpitations, none of that. And his blood pressure is 125 over 80, has a history of hypertension, but it's unclear if he's been taking his meds or not. Heart rate is normal, gets an EKG. And I'll actually show you the EKG because I have one from prior and one from now. And maybe what I'll do is I'll show you that EKG and let you know that his CBC just showed mild anemia with an MCV of 84. Creatinine is 1.5. Usually it's 1.2, but he doesn't really drink much fluid throughout the day. He only eats ramen occasionally. And we have this EKG, and then I'll pause to see what your thoughts are, what you would want next, and how do you decide, like, does he need further workup? Can he be discharged? Like, how do you navigate that space of lightheadedness? And again, his past medical history is just hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and he had a traumatic brain injury 5 years prior, but no true sequela of that. Can I show you the EKG, or do you want to talk for show you the EKG?
Whatever you think is best, Prof. Right?
Why don't you actually talk first? Because I'm
I have
curious
many
to see this.
thoughts.
I want you to go into the EKG with a hypothesis and
I
refute
have
that
so many
one.
thoughts. You have to be very careful with this story, Prof. Rez, because let's just be honest, okay? It is so interesting watching you tell the story. You first said lightheadedness, and then you said unsteady, right? Which are very different by the book, because lightheadedness triggers the idea of orthostasis. Unsteadiness triggers the idea that there's a gait problem, right? And so even you, as a seasoned presenter, oscillate between those words. Can you imagine what it's like to be a patient? Trying to describe how you actually feel. So let's just be honest about what we know. We know this person feels weird. That's all we know. And if we translate it to lightheadedness, we're coming to a conclusion about what we think why he feels weird is because he's not perfusing his brain. But if we translate it to gait unsteadiness, there's a little bit more uncertainty about whether we think he has a blood problem or whether he has an intrinsic neurological issue like a cerebellar TIA, right? And so you should really, really, as you're trying to see this patient, you should be open to the idea that all you know is he doesn't feel right. And the simple question you are asking is, does he have a brain problem or does he have a blood problem? And that's all that you can really establish at this point in time. I think what can help you make more, gain more confidence as to whether it's a brain or blood is to not ask him how precisely he feels, because the words, as you saw Prof. Rez illustrate, can be difficult for anyone to articulate, but to ask him if it's exertional discomfort or exertion independent discussion. So for me, I don't think you're going to get much return on investment by asking him to be precise about which one of those words he used, but rather to ask him, hey, when he got off the bike and started to walk, did he feel better? And if he has exertional, funky feeling, then I think lightheadedness is much more apt. So I'm curious, Prof. Ref, if he was able to relay that with more precision, in which case the EKG is way more important than it is if somebody's like, no, I just feel wobbly.
Robbie, so every time he felt lightheaded was in the context of exertion.
Ah, that's so powerful. So that's why I would translate, okay, I think he has a perfusional problem. And so immediately the way I think about perfusional problems, Prof. Rez, is I think it's powerful that you gave us the data already, is we're asking, does he have a quantitative perfusion problem or a qualitative one? Now, these are fancy words for capturing what is either the deficiency in the amount of blood that's going to his brain, which would be captured in the realm of either overt shock or milder versions of it, like presyncope or syncope, or even milder versions like continuous orthostasis. Qualitatively, When people feel lightheadedness from a blood problem without a deficiency in the amount, they might have an issue with the content of the blood. And the most common example is anemia. And thankfully, you already gave us a CBC that I didn't catch the exact number, but your cavalier rapid reading of it made me think it was under impressive, which is great. But remember the awesome, I'm going to give one example to illustrate other differential diagnoses. The main other differential diagnoses are things that poison the hemoglobin molecule, like carbon monoxide. So carbon monoxide presents like lightheadedness and whatnot. So the question that we're after in this person is, we're confident he has a perfusional problem to the brain because it's exertional. And now the question is, does he have a deficiency in the amount getting to his brain? Or does he have a normal amount, but the blood going there is simple economy class, and what he really needs is business class quality of blood going to his brain. We'll see. But those are the hypotheses I have, Rothman.
That's so powerful because it's almost like you taught me once with fatigue. Ask the question, is it exertional or not? If exertional, your cardiopulmonary blood system, and the same thing with sort of unsteady lightheadedness. So you've now categorized this as like a perfusion issue. And so I'm curious, like going into this EKG, what are you going to be screening for?
When you're asking yourself, if I'm worried that somebody's not getting enough blood to their brain, how does their cardiac electrical activity help me do that? And so what you're looking for is any problems with the rhythm that contribute enough to cause somebody's blood pressure to drop. But you're also using the fact that they don't have palpitations as a skew for what the EKG is. So I think the way that this EKG would be diagnostic is if it shows a pathological bradycardia, if it shows a sinus pauses or advanced AV block. Apart from that, what the EKG can serve for is a proxy for structural disease. So the EKG may show Q waves, may show prolonged QTC, in which case you don't see the actual problem itself, but you can see that this heart is unhealthy, which can help you generate hypotheses based on what you're seeing. So I think causality would be a pathological bradycardia, but a clue would be anything that tells you what structural issues are happening in the heart, like LVH or right axis deviation, so on and so forth.
How can we get you to say causality more often? That was so funny. All right. So, Robbie, I'm going to show you the EKG. The first EKG is like one from years ago, and the second one is from this admission.
And
And
I'm
then you
going to
can
be
just.
authentic to the ER. I never read EKGs in detail in the ER. I just like literally, I'll share my reflex impression and then we'll
Be
see.
as authentic as possible, my friend.
Okay, so the top one So the top one to me is a sinus and normal sinus rhythm. The bottom one to me, the thing that catches my eye, unfortunately, is he has anterior V1 through V2, sorry, V1 through V3 changes. And let me summarize what those changes are. He definitely has T wave inversions in V2 through V3, but he also has a little bit of depression in V1. Awesome, ProfRes. So ProfRes is being nice enough to zoom in on it for me. Perfect. So this is definitely a change in his prior. So we'll, automatically, I'll just show you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, do you mind keeping that up for just a little longer? I'm thinking, okay, this is a Wellens, and I'll talk through my differential diagnosis for Wellens. So for me, I immediately look at this and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a Wellensoid pattern because he has T wave inversions in V2 and V3. But what I'm going to do is share a quick differential diagnosis for this EKG. And there are essentially three things that can do this. The most important is that a patient has acute coronary syndrome. And this EKG is as a result of spontaneous thrombolysis. The other possibility is that this patient has a pulmonary embolism. And the clues to the presence of a pulmonary embolism are a Wellens-like pattern, but with associated similar changes in the inferior leads, which unfortunately for him, he has. So he has a T wave inversions in lead three and lead AVF, which have me a little bit worried about that possibility of PE. The third differential diagnosis that causes is Takotsubo's. And there are some other changes that in AVR that are at place. But honestly, when I see this, I think, okay, I can park the bus at Welland. And so when I see this, the patient's not going to be discharged. And I think admitting the patient is key. And the decision that's left for me in the ER is, do I get a CTPE, yes or no? And for me, the only thing that would stop me from getting a CTPE in this patient is if his troponin were disproportionately elevated, meaning that since his vital signs are not abnormal, if he has a PE, his troponin should be underwhelming. But if his troponin is markedly high, I would be happy with a diagnosis of ACS and treat him as such. So, Professor, I'm talking a lot, but so I maybe we can have a dialogue or whatnot. But I think I see this and I worry that an abrupt onset lightheadedness syndrome with this EKG change really has, for me, PE ACS in that order, with the troponin being a realistic tiebreaker between the two. I'm also not, I'm also been trained to think anytime that I think something potentially in the brain and these changes, not to overlook the possibility of cerebral T waves. So I would want to do a really, really good neuro exam and review to see he's not on anticoagulant, which I don't think he is, to make sure this is not the brain. So that's my checklist.
So, Robbie, before you saw the EKG,
Yeah.
actually, you didn't even mention a single diagnosis. I'm just more
Yeah.
curious to ask you,
Yeah.
was PE in an ACS and brain, was that all like in the back, or were you still trying to define the problem, like perfusion versus unsteady? Like, I'm just curious, or did the EKG put that specific diagnosis of PE, ACS, et cetera, into your
Very
mind?
good question. Yeah, Proffers, I think all that was in my mind was, as I said, like exactly what I said to you, there's not enough blood getting to his brain. Now, if I don't do this in the ER because we move too quickly, but if I were to sit to that, it's not the only thing I know. I also know that he abruptly stopped getting blood to his brain, right? So if you ask yourself, like most people who have lightheadedness, what's the average story of lightheadedness? You see this all the time, Profrez. Hey doc, last 3 or 4 days, not feeling great, this, that. And then you either get a story of diarrhea, diuretics, or you see that pesky Entresto or ACE inhibitor and you're like, oh, okay, no problem. So he's not that, right? And if we break down problems with blood not getting to the brain into either there's something in the heart or there's something in the vessels. The vessel diseases like diarrhea, dehydration, diuretics are more slow versus the cardiac hypotheses are more abrupt. So the honest answer is that when people say it's abrupt, it's often not actually abrupt and it's abrupt recognition. So if I were seeing him in the ER, I would be like, oh yeah, the medical textbook tells me you have abrupt lightheadedness. I should worry about your heart. But real life integration tells me that you probably have abrupt recognition, and I will get your EKG, but it will probably be normal. And then I'll realize that you know your ACE has been on and probably at too much a dose, and you just realized on your bike because today you didn't drink enough. So, but now with this EKG, you go back and you're like, no, he really, I believe that he really was on his bike. He was cruising, and he has this, or at least now I have to disprove the actual story that he's sharing.
So, and one more question for you. Your
Yeah.
threshold to get an EKG, would you get it in everyone with lightheadedness,
Oh,
or
heck
what's it?
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Profrez. Yeah, definitely. So you know, this is why do I get it in everybody who has I don't feel right? No. But if I that's why I said like it's so important to I'm so glad you pushed me to stop before the EKG because do I get an EKG in somebody who has disequilibrium? No. Right? Like if we said if he said, hey, no, I just feel don't feel right, but if he continues to not feel right, and I can walk him and he feels not right, even when he walks at a brisk pace, then I'm going into a whole different world. But do I get an EKG in everybody who has exertion-dependent lightheadedness? Oh, definitely. Yeah. But see, it's about defining the problem and getting the label right of the problem. This easily could have gone into like he has a subdural because he fell off his bike and he has more continuous sense of uneasiness.
Okay, so what ends up happening is he gets a troponin. The first one is 46, high sensitivity.
Yeah.
Normal is less than 20 in our lab. The second one is 41. He feels great. Like his blood pressure is normal, feels good. You know how you always say the eating, the walking,
Eat, walk, and
the
talk.
talking?
Yeah.
He meets all three of Robbie's criteria for discharge. I know, but
Hey.
Robbie wouldn't discharge. He already made that very clear.
Oh.
So he gets discharged. This is just what happened. He gets discharged, and when I read the note, it was that, his vitals are normal, the trope wasn't too elevated, and it was sort of like pre-syncope. Maybe there's some dehydration. He has a little bit of an AKI. As he gets discharged to walk towards his home, he's like walking under a bridge and then has a full-on syncopal episode witnessed by a bystander. They call EMS. He's like vomiting in the ambulance. He's awake, like little out of it. It's brought back to the emergency department. Like it's like a few hours after his discharge, maybe even 30 minutes after his discharge. And he's brought back. His blood pressure is 160 over 90. And his high sensitive troponin now is 79. And a proBNP is sent, and it's 6,000. And they get a chest X-ray now. Okay, they get a chest X-ray. And let me show you the chest X-ray for you to. But actually, before reading the chest X-ray, maybe you can share some thoughts, and then I'll show you the chest X-ray.
Professor, I think that the fact that he syncopized, I think just as a marker of, the truth is we don't know he syncopized, but I think the fact that he came right back to it in the context of exertional lightheadedness has that be the wisest problem representation. The fact that he's vomiting after is just a, I think, a marker. I don't create any specificity to it, but I think whenever you're seriously sick, some people get very sympathetic and some people get very vagal. You said he was hypertensive afterwards, which I think is just probably more autonomic than anything else in his body trying to recover. So, if I'm, going back to the original differential diagnosis, which of those two, ACS or PE? I'm also tracking the possibility he might have something in his brain, Profrez. But if he has ACS or PE, which one is more likely to present with syncope? It's definitely a pulmonary embolism, though there are instances where ACS can present with syncope, but it would require a second order mechanism. Like it would require ACS-induced VT or ACS-induced ACS purely presents with a continuous syndrome that gets worse and worse and worse and worse rather than PE. Which has some cool mechanisms it can present with a syncopal event. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Curious what the
So,
X-ray would show. Yeah.
yeah, let's see that chest X-ray.
Yeah.
And I can zoom out a little bit, make it easier for you. Here you go.
Okay. Wow, this is very, very different, crazy X-ray process. So, the major abnormality in this X-ray that I see is that his mediastinum looks really, really odd and really enlarged. So I'm trying to make sure I'm not missing a pneumothorax. I don't see that. I don't see any a pleural disease. But he has very impressive widening of the mediastinum. So this is very, very alarming. I think the tube of truth of the CT is definitely the right thing to do. What this could mean in terms of the original hypotheses, I think aortic dissection definitely wasn't on my mind as a presentation of exertional lightheadedness. The way prompted by this X-ray and the benefit of not having to rush to diagnose this patient and manage this patient, the way that aortic dissection might be implicated in a transient loss of consciousness event is really, really interesting and essentially has to do with focal cerebral hypoperfusion as the dissection extends into the ne cervical vessels. There's also this really cool mechanism of an aortic dissection presenting with high vagal tone from the abrupt rupture. I don't have a way of reconciling the aortic dissection with the EKG apart from when I shared the idea that Takotsubos could be at play. The deeper concept in Takotsubos is whenever you have those S, those T wave changes, It's just a marker of sympathetic excess on the heart. And so you can easily imagine why somebody with an aortic dissection has a sudden onset sympathetic excess in their heart. But this is now a very, very serious issue. And the patient definitely needs a CT scan. And now what's changed with the CT scan is I'm prioritizing an aortic dissection protocol as opposed to a PE protocol. And the good news is that you'll still get most of the main and segmental branches. You might not get subsegmental PEs, which are probably okay in a scenario like this.
And
There.
Robbie, I'm definitely sharing this with you as it like occurred. Like I'm not editorializing or saying anything. So what happens is that he does get the CT head, which is negative, and then based on this chest X-ray, not based on an EKG finding or his clinical presentation or his recurrent, lightheadedness slash syncope, not based on any of that, but based on this chest X-ray, gets a CTA protocolized for a dissection. And I just texted it to your phone, if you don't mind looking at your phone and looking at that video. And
Actually, I have it on my laptop, so let me open
oh,
it.
beautiful. And then you can walk us through what you find and what you would do next, for this patient. I feel like I gotta put music in the band. Do,
Oh wow,
do, do,
amazing, Prof.
do,
Rez.
do, do,
Okay.
do, do.
Wow, so I don't think I'm so, his presentation makes sense. Thank God. I was like, I'm gonna have to read about 100 million hours for this, but I'm maybe Prof Rez, what I'll do is because I imagine it's probably easier for Matt to upload pictures, so I'll just Carol is here. Carol should come look at this CT. It's crazy. We're recording, but I'm being facetious. This patient has a high burden of pulmonary emboli, Prof Rez. So he has, I'll just take a snapshot of where I'm talking. So he has basically a saddle pulmonary embolism that bridges both the right and left main pulmonary trunks. I'm looking now to see what's happening. And unfortunately for him, his RV is way bigger than his LV2. He's got septal deviation to the left. So this is a very, very serious situation. I think the next steps. So what happened? What RVA is very well prepared for this scenario, Prof Rez, which, as it should, takes the onus on the very the job of the ER doctors to diagnose this, not to sit there and fine tune whether the patient should get thrombolysis or not. So we have a PE response team. So this would get an automatic call to the PE response team. And what would I be responsible for? I would be responsible for doing a thorough review of systems about bleeding. And then thinking about the head, making sure the patient, if they hit their head, that gets, which a patient with syncope, you definitely have to do a head strike. And then getting a weight to make sure we can dose the heparin and enoxaparin. And I think I would be engaging it. The conversation would be in a patient like this about not just anticoagulation, but the nuances of thrombolysis, which I'm sure we can touch on or discuss. But what would I actually be doing? I'd be like, okay, we have an answer now. And then I would call the PE response team. And just like ACS, these are complicated decisions that shouldn't fall on one person. It should be a multidisciplinary team. In RVA, it's IR, pulmonary, and hematology, anticoagulation that could convene to talk about this and what to do next.
Dude, you gave me goosebumps. And let me sort of wrap this up because I don't think our focus is like who should get catheter-guided
Please, please
thrombolysis.
no.
That's beyond RLR, but
Yeah,
I
maybe.
have to share a story with the audience. Let me just wrap this case up first and then let you reflect and stuff. But I do want to share a story. So he gets diagnosed with an intermediate risk PE, and they have their own calculations. The pulmonary embolism response team is contacted. And the very next day, he's placed on a heparin drip initially. And then the very next day, he is administered thrombolysis through a catheter, tolerates it like a champion. And I will, after this Zoom chat is over, look at his final EKG after the thrombolysis to see if that pattern you so astutely recognize reverses. But he walks out of the hospital, no more lightheadedness. And, is doing well. I will say he did have severe iron deficiency anemia, never has had a colonoscopy. So they did make a referral to GI for a colonoscopy, age-appropriate cancer screening. They also sent a lot of the hypercoagulable workup, including factor V Leiden, protein CNS, additionally, beta-2 glycoprotein antibody. et cetera. Everything was negative, but he really does need that colonoscopy. Now, when we were recently, and we have to share this story with the audience, when we were recently in Portland, Maine, which the hosts were unbelievable. In fact, their chair of medicine, he is a transplant nephrologist. And because he wanted to walk the walk, he donated his kidney to one of his patients. Just think about that. That puts faith in humanity. Actually, both Robbie and I, our eyes started tearing up when we heard that story. And I was like, we're not worthy to be in front of you right now.
And then Reza proceeded to give him all our books.
Oh, yeah, we had to talk about that. But we were presenting a case there, and it was a really cool presentation. And the patient ended up having hemolysis. They ended up having multiple emboli, cancer emboli to the brain. And on slide three, like the presenter had like nine slides prepared for us. On slide three, Robbie's like, I don't know how we can get through this case without a bone marrow biopsy. Looking for her because the patient had a history of metastatic breast cancer, or had a history of breast cancer, looking for metastatic breast cancer causing intramedullary hemolysis leading to cancer.
Are you going to be able to
Embolism.
finish that sentence, Brad?
Robbie's turning red right now because look, we're being very honest with the group here. And he came up to me, he's like, Rez, I have like a little, I have a sad. I was like, why do you feel sad? He's like, man, I don't want this to be about me, because afterwards we had a Q&A and every question was like, Robbie, how did you get to the answer so quickly?
You're killing me, Fabian.
Anyways, the reason I'm laughing so hard
You're
is because
killing me.
literally I nicknamed Robbie Slide 3 Robbie, and it was like in the third aliquot of information, he's like, this is a PE. But let's be honest here. This really, I mean, you're a smart person. A lot of people are smart. But I know in our VMRs, we had multiple EKGs like this.
Yes.
And if you think about it, like you didn't need to actually see a patient with this EKG finding to be able to diagnose it through pattern recognition. And Robbie, this story could have turned out the patient was discharged, died, and we have no idea why they
100%.
died. No autopsies done. So I just want you for a minute later today, after you reflect with the audience, I really want you to just take a hot shower, go in your jacuzzi, and just be
In my
proud of you.
jacuzzi.
Go in your jacuzzi and just be so proud of yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You really would have saved a life. Like this
Yeah.
life could have, and look, no one mentioned the EKG findings, the pattern that you recognize,
Right.
and I'm not saying anything bad about them. I
Right.
wouldn't have
Totally.
recognized that if it were not for what the VMR and the likes have taught me. So this is not about saying, oh, people miss it. No, 99% of us would have missed that. But if you spend the time, or you if you listen to this RLR episode and you go on our website and you look at that EKG, you will never miss it. And Robbie will hopefully share some kind of schema on Evernote with us. So then, in 10 years, you can text us and say, hey guys, thank you for pointing that out. You thank Robbie for sharing the pattern, but you thank Reza for presenting the case that led to Robbie sharing the pattern and that led to you diagnosing it in your patient.
Professor, I have so many reflections, but I talk way too much. I'll tell you that if you guys look at that EKG, there's essentially two really powerful clues that suggest PE. The first is you just have to anchor yourself in what Wellens is. Wellens are anterior T wave inversions, or sort of T wave inversions in V2 and V3. There are two separate clues that reinforce the possibility of PE. First is that Wellens, when it represents ACS, very rarely extends to V1, extremely rarely. And so V1 is also affected by this. And so that should be a trigger to the possibility of PE. And then I think the most alarming is the inferior leads 3 and AVF. Very, very suggestive of the possibility of PE. Then if you look more closely, you'll see that the patient is tachycardic. I mean, this is sinus tachycardia. And 300, 150, like basically borderline tachycardic. And sinus tachycardia plus these changes is another clue for PE, because patients, as Prof. Rez has told us many, many times, patients with ACS rarely have sinus tachycardia. And then the underwhelming troponin. The troponin in patients with ACS is proportionally high. And here, a troponin that is barely twice the upper limit of normal should not. What happens with an underwhelming troponin is we worry less, but we should worry about different things, I think, is the ultimate takeaway. But Prof, as you know, I think, I don't know, I don't feel pride, honestly. I feel like all of us are on a lifelong journey to learn more and more and more and more. And I think there's nothing like this community and us hanging out that, hopefully pushes us. But the reason I don't feel proud, Prof, is I'm still too hungry to feel pride. I got so much more left to learn that, like, over the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And maybe like, honestly, maybe at the end I'll be like, oh, cool, I learned something about it. It's too much left to do, honestly. But I really hope that, if you found this, like, if you found this inspiring, then, the formula to keep doing this yourself is very simple. Keep at it, keep joining us, keep reading on your own. And honestly, this is what the book is about. So this is the most authentic plug to get the book. If you enjoyed this and like this kind of stuff, that's what this book is for. And hopefully you can push us to release version 2, 3, and give us that momentum to keep all these projects going.
And one more thing for you to be
Yeah.
proud. The
Yeah.
RV, the way you read the RV on that CT scan was exactly how the radiologist read
Oh
it.
yeah, I forgot to ask you. Yeah.
Exactly. And the POCUS also demonstrated that. But it just,
Yeah.
I just like, you represent what anyone can be in medicine
Yeah,
with,
100%.
dedication. And again,
Yeah.
now our audience members will recognize this
Yes.
pattern, and they, one of them will save a life.
Yeah,
They
100%.
will. And we'll be so proud of them when they do that. And I like for you to look at that EKG, no one even brought up PE, and it was an erroneous CTA for an aortic dissection because of a chest X-ray that was probably more artifact than anything.
Yeah.
But it was really this EKG, and I think it's 10% of PEs present with syncope, but that's always easy to say
100%.
afterwards. Like, yeah, this guy could have died. I'm glad he didn't. He did well.
Yeah.
And I think we can all be better because of this case.
For the mega nerds who are still here, there's a really important question for us as teachers to address, Profrez, which is why can PE present a syncope? Right? Because the blockage is there. If a patient plummets their blood pressure to cause syncope, how do they wake up again? And the answer I thought was that they would have spontaneous thrombolysis and they would break up some of their clot and they would perfuse. Again, that's not the correct answer. This is the power of reading and reflection. I want all of you, I won't talk about it, all of you to read about the Bezold-Jerish reflex. And it'll hopefully inspire even more reading and learning. So patients with PE syncopized, not because of anything else, but because of a pathological vagal response that they have. It's called the Bezold-Jerish reflex. It's a really good read. So I
Is
hope.
this the same Jerish from Derek Schirksheimer?
Now you see, this is why I cannot be proud, Prof. There's so much left to learn. I don't know.
You're like, who cares, Rez?
Don't
Yeah.
know, man. I don't know the guy. Dude.
That's a wrap, folks.
Woo!